I begin this morning with my own translation of the very beginning of the letter to the Hebrews, and it will become clearer as we go along, if you bear with me, why I do so. The most eloquent letter in the New Testament is the letter to the Hebrews. We don't know its author. It's usually expected to be Paul, but probably isn't. But the author writes at the very beginning, "In times past, God spoke to our forebears in fragmentary and varied ways by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by a Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things. Through Him, He created the universe. He is the radiance, the effulgence of God's glory, the exact image of God's very being, sustaining all things by His powerful word." Thus begins the letter to the Hebrews. Wonderful word, the effulgence. Look it up. The effulgence. Just think, you could just feel it. The exact imprint of God's being. Effulgence can be defined as brightness of radiance taken to the extreme. You may be dazzled by it. You may be stunned by it. You may be even overcome by it. Now, usually this passage is taken by commentators to be a reference to, and theologians as well, to be a reference to the fact that in the person of Jesus, we see, in the terminology of doctrine, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, the second person of the Godhead. Where Jesus is seen, there also God is seen. But conversely, it's interesting, if you turn that around, Jesus as a human being also not only epitomizes the very being of God, He epitomizes the very essence of what it means to be human. And there is a dignity in that for all human beings. The meaning of the incarnation, of what we celebrate at Christmas as one of the greatest mysteries of the church, celebrates the dignity of every human being. And in a certain sense, you could say that the readings this weekend all have to do with the dignity, the inviolability of the human person. We began this morning with a letter with the book of Job. If we look at the book of Job carefully, we discover that it has been reworked. Originally, it was a piece of literature, a story, an epic taken out of the Mesopotamian tradition, honoring the integrity of this individual. He's a non-Israelite. We're told that at the very beginning. He's born in the land of Uz, and he lives there. He stands before God, and he stands before his friends, well-meaning those friends may be, and he proclaims over and over again his integrity and his innocence. Christian writers have seen him as a type, as a prefigurement of Jesus himself. Here is a man who dares to stand before other human beings and say, "I am a person of integrity. I am upright before God. I have done nothing to deserve the sufferings that have been inflicted upon me." He even stands before God and says that. Now, later writers, some centuries later, have kind of added to that. And at the end of the book of Job, what you find is a story about God's omnipotence, God's transcendence, making Job still innocent, still a person of integrity, but in the face of God, someone who has to deal with mystery in suffering. But originally, he is inviolate before God. Now, his friends really speak past him. They're not too much interested in Job as a person. They're interested in giving him what you might call the party line. A few weeks ago when I preached, I told you about, or we reflected upon, the difference between a preceptive religion, a religion following rule and precept. His friends are filled with the cliches of preceptive religion. You must have done something wrong or you wouldn't have suffered in this way. And they approach it from different points of view, but the bottom line is always, Job, you must have done something to offend God. And in the face of that, Job says, not true. I am innocent before God and before man. Now, we look to the New Testament reading from the Gospel and we see somewhat the same thing. A reflective upon preceptive religion, preceptive faith, a rule of the faith of rules and regulations, propositions and doctrines. Jesus is asked about divorce. And I can think of no other passage in the Scriptures that, in my mind at least, gets things as wrong as we usually tend to interpret this passage. It's taken by most people and by most churches as a precept. Divorce is wrong. It is bad. Therefore, it's to be outlawed. We find countries in Europe that are still struggling with that whole business. But if we look at the story, we look at it in its historical matrix, we discover there is no such thing as sacraments then. Instead, according to the law of Moses and according to the practices of the day, a woman could be handed a writ of divorce for something as simple as not keeping the house as clean as it should be, burning her husband's food, whatever. Women were considered property. And to dismiss a wife was simply a matter of writing out a writ of divorce, having it notarized by a scribe, and handing it to her. And that meant she left the household, and unless she had a relative who was willing to support her, she was left to her own devices as to how to live. When we look at this passage in its historical context and its matrix, what we discover is that far from it being a prohibition of divorce, what Jesus is saying is, according to the Scriptures and even in the Old Testament, this person cannot be treated as property. This person has a dignity that is rightfully hers before God and cannot be dismissed in this way. You notice he's not talking about an offense against the Father. He's talking about an offense against this woman. I can remember a time when I was a much younger priest in my first parish, an experience that I had that changed my thinking completely. A woman came in who was probably in her early 50s, and she talked about a situation, tearfully talked about a situation with her husband who was given to drink and could become verbally and physically abusive in situations like that. And of course, there was this prohibition against divorce. Now, I'm not trying to condone divorce for any and every circumstance. 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, the same woman came back with her daughter and had photos of bruises on her body. And a daughter who was able to corroborate some of what this lady was saying in terms of the abuse that she had to deal with on, if not a day-to-day basis, then on a week-to-week basis. The emotional uncertainty of not knowing what you are going to face, and the physical ramifications of a person out of control. Certainly the dignity of the individual was not being heeded there. And I came to the conclusion that when we talk about protecting the dignity of what some people, some churches consider a sacrament, it's not the sacrament that needs protecting, it's people. The dignity of the human individual, the person before God. Now, this has given rise to a whole, you might say, a whole strain of philosophy. We'll call it Christian personalism. But in the bottom line, in all of it, is each and every one of us, and this is something that is so sorely needed for our time, when people are thought to be means to an end rather than as ends in themselves. In the light of the Me Too movement, in the light of what is happening in the rancor of our political world, nationally and internationally, where people are dispensable pawns who are used and can be used in order to further ends, in the face of that, the gospel has to say, has to stand up and say, no. No. It can never be this way. The individual before God is sacred. The individual before God is holy. The individual before God, based upon what we read at the very beginning in the letter to the Hebrews, if Jesus epitomizes what God is to us, he also epitomizes what we should be to one another. The striving for compassion, the striving for justice, the striving for the recognition of the spark of God's presence in each one of us is something that is laid upon us not as a precept. We don't do this because in order we can earn brownie points with God and make our way to heaven. We do this because we are loved and treated as lovable in the present. And we owe that to one another. We owe that recognition of the sacredness and the dignity of every individual. We owe that to one another. I think in the East they've understood this maybe a little bit better than we have. Yesterday we had dinner in the evening at a place called Namaste. I'm not trying to put in a commercial plug for anybody, but it was good food, good company. Namaste, the greeting. What it means literally is I bow you. If we expand upon that greeting, what it means is the sacredness, the holiness, the divine presence in me recognizes and pays reverence to the sacredness, the holiness, and the divine presence in you. We don't get to that understanding by our current level of consciousness. If you are in part of the class in the cloud of unknowing or part of our adult education offering these last few Sundays or this morning, you know that we don't get to that point by doing the same things over and over again. We have to develop what we might call in the Zen tradition the beginner's mind, the mind that is open, not closed, the mind that is open to possibilities, the mind that is open to living with ambiguity, the mind that is open to living with the possibility that somebody else could be right and I may be wrong. That's the beginning. The end result of that is holding each other, whether in prayer, in consciousness, in mindfulness, holding each other gently. Because as human beings, God knows we can be fragile. God knows some of our experiences earlier on in life can stay with us. God knows that in our lives in the present, we need each other. God also knows that we need, if we're going to get to that point, if we're going to get to the point where nations and peoples change, hearts and consciousness needs to change. And so for the sake of the compassion that we owe one another, for the justice that needs to be done in our world, heed the words of the gospel. Heed the words of what the Spirit would teach God's people this weekend. I, recognizing and holding sacred the good and the divine presence in me, recognize and hold dear and treat gently the divine presence in you. Let us treat one another gently, kindly, justly, in the name of the Lord. Amen.